Kind of got a chance to look at the Transfiguration last week, and we didn't really spend a whole lot of time digging into the conversation that Jesus and the disciples had as they were going down the mountain. It's mentioned there by the disciples that they ask Jesus about Elijah. The scribes have rightly kind of determined, they've come up with the idea that Elijah must first come before the kingdom comes, or perhaps before the Messiah comes. As we read in Malachi, that's the prophecy that they were talking about. Elijah is going to come before before the Lord. He's going to be preparing the way before the Lord, who's going to come to his holy temple and refine the sons of Levi. And he's going to come before the great day of the Lord, which is a day both of salvation and judgment. The day of the Lord is a big theme throughout the prophets. And we're not told here what prompts the disciples and the question that they ask. So as they're coming down the mountain, Jesus gives them the exhortation, you know, don't tell anybody about what you just witnessed until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And then the disciples ask him, then why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? So that's where we're going to pick up this section. And let me read through the end of the chapter, and then we'll start digging in there. So this is Matthew 17, verse 10. The disciples asked him, then why did the scribes say that the first Elijah must come? And he answered, Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to him and, kneeling before him, said, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic, and he suffers terribly. For often he falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not heal him. And Jesus answered, O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was healed instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, Why could we not cast it out? He said to them, Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, Move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day. And they were greatly distressed. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, Does your teacher not pay the tax? He said, Yes. And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? And when he said, From others, Jesus said to him, Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. So we kind of have a hodgepodge of stories here, dealing with a variety of different things. We have the concept of Elijah, the restoration of all things. That would be kind of a more of a eschatological topic or conversation. We have the account in which immediately meets Jesus and the disciples when they get down to the base of the mountain, which has to do with faith, how it works. And we have another statement, a prediction about what is going to happen to Jesus when he gets to Jerusalem. And then we have that interesting conversation between Peter and Jesus about whether or not they should pay the temple tax. Two of these kind of occur publicly, and then there's a private conversation that takes place on the side. So instead of trying to find like a united common theme throughout all of these, we're just going to kind of look at them individually as we go through. There's kind of an attempt here to wrap up and continue to weave the ideas of both on the one hand, discipleship, and on the other hand, of what it means to follow Jesus. We've already seen these in chapter 16, in the beginning of chapter 17, that the cross and the glory go together. The cross and the suffering king go together. That they cannot be divided, they cannot be split up. They actually fully help us to understand what Jesus' role is and what it means for his followers. There's a little bit of that going on in our passage today. About Elijah, the question that the disciples raise, that perhaps they have been taught by the scribes themselves, why do the scribes say that Elijah first must come? And they're reading and picking up, like I said, on Malachi chapter 3 and chapter 5. Chapter 4. We don't know what prompted this, but Elijah was one of the guys who showed up at the Transfiguration. So it could have been his presence there that it would have evoked perhaps this question that they have in their minds about what role is Elijah going to have before the Messiah comes or before the kingdom of God comes? What role does he have? Why do they say that this is going to take place? Jesus here does not disagree with the scribes. He actually says they're right. The scribes are right that Elijah must come first. He must come, and he must or he will restore all things. He will restore everything. So what role then does Elijah have? We can kind of see that restoring all things in a kind of a complete way, which would then raise the question, well, if Elijah restores everything, then what is the Messiah going to do? But I think we have to understand this in light of who Elijah actually is. And as he says in verse 13, or as Matthew tells us, the disciples understood that Jesus was talking about John the Baptist. John the Baptist actually fulfilled this role of the Elijah-like prophet that was going to come, and he was going to prepare the way for the Lord. And he did so through his proclamation of the kingdom and his practice of baptizing those who repented. So his restoration then is Elijah actually fulfilling his responsibility, or John the Baptist fulfilling his responsibility to prepare the people for the Lord's arrival. So yes, we don't see this as a kind of a complete or a total restoration. That is what the Messiah actually accomplishes in terms of reconciling heaven and earth and providing a sufficient atonement for our sins and ushering in the new creation. That's the Messiah's work. That is not Elijah's work, but Elijah is there to get the people ready for what the Messiah is going to do. And here, the shadow that's cast over the passage, again, is the idea of suffering. What happened to Elijah is what's going to happen to the Messiah, the Son of Man. Just as Elijah suffered and they did to him whatever they wanted to do, so also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. So that is the shadow that's cast over almost all of these conversations now. Now that Jesus has begun to show his disciples what must happen to him when he goes to Jerusalem, we know that that is the result. That's what's going to happen. There's much more to say about that, but we're going to continue to move through this. Once they get down to the bottom of the mountain, they encounter a very distressing situation. And interestingly, the focus in Matthew here is not necessarily upon the Father or even the Son, but it's upon his own disciples. They have been left in charge as Jesus and Peter and James and John have gone up to the top of the mountain. So they've left the nine disciples behind. And then when they get back, there's a bunch of chaos taking place. Interestingly, I think we've heard similar stories before. What happened when Moses ascended to the mountain, which we saw that was actually alluded to in the Transfiguration passage. Moses going up into the mountain, going up into the cloud, coming back down with his face shining from the glory of the glory of the Lord. And what did he encounter when he got down to the bottom of the mountain? Chaos, idolatry, Aaron, you know, just somehow throwing some gold into a fire and out popping a golden calf, and all of this false worship taking place. I think we're to think of that passage as we read through this, as we look at the layers that's taking place here. Not to say that it's the same situation, but I think there's definitely some ways in which this passage is actually informed by what takes place when Moses comes down the mountain. You think of what Jesus says here as he laments the faithless and twisted generation. Now, those were words that Moses used to describe his own generation. Think of the way that Moses was grieved by the idolatry of the people. You think of the way that Jesus is distressed now about their lack of faith. So there are definitely some comparisons that are taking place. But that's what happens when you come off the glory mountain. That's what happens when you come off from those experiences of the glory, the surpassing glory of God on the mountain. You come back down to earth. And this is what happens. There's a very distressing situation. A father is desperate, and the disciples have failed to heal him, heal his son. So let's pick this up in verse 14. They came to the crowd. So whether or not these people were waiting for him, we don't know. But out of the crowd, a man came up to him and kneeling before him and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and he suffers terribly." Listen to how this is described. And Matthew gives us a very short description actually here. I think Mark, if you read Mark's account of this, this is multiple verses that are going on, but Matthew just gives us the one. "Have mercy on me. My son is an epileptic and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water." So something has happened to this child. We know basically by what takes place when he is healed that this is perhaps brought on by some sort of demon. This child has been possessed by a demon of some sort, and he is exerting some sort of control over his life. He is suffering fits, and he is suffering terribly, and he is often falling into the fire or falling into the water. So this is something that is happening repeatedly. This is what the child is actually going through. Some sort of seizures, or what's translated epilepsy here. The word is actually literally translated as moonstruck, and the idea that older generations used to associate with the power of the moon. So you think of the word lunatic, that's related to this word here. It's translated here as epileptic because they think that the fits that were going on, the seizures were taking place, were actually something from related to epilepsy. We could assume that. We don't really actually know. The word that's translated epileptic here is not usually associated to describe seizures 2,000 years ago. So there could be some sort of relationship here. We don't actually know. But obviously the child is suffering. He's having some sort of fits or convulsions. He's frequently being cast or thrown into the fire, or falling into the fire, falling into the water. It seems like this demon that's taking control of him is bent on destroying him. And that's the situation that we find when you come down the mountain. The father is absolutely desperate. He had perhaps one last hope that the disciples would be able to heal his son. Now he appeals to Jesus. He comes down before him. He kneels before him. Again, that the symbolism of worship, addressing him as Lord and asking for mercy. Very similar, I think, to what we saw with the woman from Canaan, where she cries out to Jesus, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." Very similar address here. "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic." So we can't think of a more helpless situation for the father, a more dangerous situation for the son. It seems that he's got to watch him constantly because we never know when he's going to fall into the fire and fall into water, you know, whatever else was taking place. There's definitely a level of helplessness there. But the desperate situation then is heightened by the fact that he could not be healed by the disciples. I brought him to your disciples and they could not heal him. They were unable to heal him. You think of all of the things that he's heard about Jesus, perhaps. All of the things that he's maybe even seen him do. And his hope was placed upon on these nine guys who were left in charge as Jesus and his inner circle ascended to the top of the mountain. They could not heal him. That word "could not" is actually picked up two other times in this passage. So really what we see here, we see a picture, a description of the inability of Jesus' disciples. We know that the root cause of this is going to be their lack of faith, which is going to be addressed in a moment. But before we get there, Jesus responds to this situation as he gets to the bottom of the mountain, as he hears the plea of this father, and he laments himself. And Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" We don't typically see Jesus lament like this. What we do need to see and try to understand is, who is this lamentation? Who is this directed toward? What is he actually distressed about? Who is causing this distress? And what does this show us about Jesus? Is I think, looking at the language that's used here, this exasperated lament seems to be directed to a more general audience. O faithless and twisted or perverse or crooked generation. So the word generation there is something we've already seen a couple times. And it's usually associated with the crowds. It could be associated with the scribes and the Pharisees, right? An evil and adulterous generation looks for a sign. When Jesus was already teaching the people about John the Baptist, what he asks the hypothetical question, you know, to what shall I compare this generation? They're like children that are being beckoned to come and play and sing, and yet they stay in the sidelines. They don't understand the situation that they find themselves in. He's describing the crowds in that way. He's describing the religious leaders in that way. This could be a kind of a general description as well. He's describing not just the disciples, but he's describing the crowds. He doesn't seem to be addressing the Father. I think we can determine that for sure. But the crowds are kind of ambivalent. Perhaps they're skeptical. Perhaps they think, well, this boy is way too far gone. There's nothing that can be done for him. Perhaps that's their perspective. We're not actually sure. Now we see that he's going to be addressing the failure of the disciples. So I think it's probably best to see this as a description or a rebuke of the faithlessness of the disciples. Now that would be, admittedly, that's an odd way of referring to his disciples, calling them a generation. But it could be kind of a situation in which they are perhaps influenced by a wider faithlessness of the people. They could be influenced by the crookedness of the people, not to see a solution to the situation that they're in. They could be influenced to doubt whether or not they can actually bring healing to this child. We're not really sure, but it does seem like he's addressing them specifically. They are unable to do this, to heal this child, because of their little faith, which would seem to make sense when he addresses them as being faithless. We'll see here as we get to chapter or verse 20 that their little faith really isn't a faith at all. So this is what happens in Jesus' absence. His disciples falter. His disciples go astray. His disciples stop trusting, stop believing. They start participating in crooked, evil, perverse things. these disciples, and with their special access to Jesus, their privileged position, are actually failing to carry out what they've been commissioned to do. What hope is there for anyone else if the disciples cannot even bring healing to this child? So then if it's the disciples that Jesus laments, that raises another question. Didn't Jesus give them power to cast out evil spirits? And they go, well, yes, he did. Actually, just a few chapters earlier. Matthew chapter 10, verse 1. And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction. In verse 8 of that same passage, he commissioned them. Remember, he sent them out. Don't go to the Gentiles. Don't go to the foreign cities. Go to the Jews. Go and heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. That is what they have actually been given authority to do. And Matthew doesn't actually record them doing any of that, but Luke does. And when they return from this little short missionary trip that they took, what do they say? They're excited because the demons are subject to us in your name. They rejoice that they have power, control over the demons. Luke 10:17, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. So it's likely that they have experienced a little bit of success in doing this. So if they have experienced success, then why is there a failure here? What makes this situation different than the other experiences that they've had? That's the question that we have to answer. And before we get there, we have to look at this and see what it tells us about Jesus. It's important for us to recognize, especially after the transfiguration, Jesus' lament here about the faithlessness and the perversion of this generation. I think sometimes we may emphasize transfiguration-like qualities of Jesus more than human-like qualities of Jesus, right? He is the Lord of glory. He is the divine Son of the living God, the second person of the Trinity. We may emphasize those things at the expense of his humanity. Jesus is perhaps somewhat stoic. He wasn't really tempted by sin because God cannot be tempted by evil. You know, that type of argument. He was perhaps a little bit robotic. He was simply just going through the motions as a man. Perhaps he was a little bit removed from the fluctuating emotions of our day. You know, we experience a wide variety of emotions, some more than others. And Jesus was kind of kept from that. But here, what we see is we have Jesus being distressed, exasperated, I would even say frustrated by his disciples' lack of faith. The questions that Jesus asks, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Seem to express the idea that Jesus is sick and tired of being with his disciples and putting up with their failures. I don't know if we would go that far, but it seems as if the patience of the long-suffering Lord seems to be exhausted. He's at his wit's end. How much longer does he have to spend his time with these people to bear with them? I think that's somewhat challenging, and I don't know how far we should push this, because as I was going down this road, I was thinking, well, I don't want Jesus to be impatient with me. But that seems to be where he's at. That very stern command then at the end of verse 17, this command, bring him to me. He's like, I'm done with putting up with your failures. Let me fix the problem. Let me provide the solution. So we see Jesus participating in the distress of the psalmist. How long, O Lord? How long am I going to see evil win? How long am I going to see these perverse, wicked people succeed? How long is this going to happen? Again, that casts the shadow over his life, knowing that in the impending, the months that his death is there at the end. His death is waiting for him. His visit with his disciples is only temporary. So it helps us to see a different side of Jesus. Now after this lament, Jesus orders the boy to be brought to him. He rebukes the demon, and the boy is healed. So then the issue of the disciples' inability is brought up again. It's actually brought up by the disciples later in private. Now maybe they wanted to save face. Maybe they've already seen that their status among the crowds is diminished because they tried as hard as they could to get this demon out and they couldn't actually do it. But Jesus provides this correction to them personally in private. That's where they ask the question, why can't we do this? Why couldn't we cast this demon out? They're as perplexed as the crowds probably were. Like, we don't know. We've done it before. We couldn't do it this time. What's going on here? So they ask the question. They're wondering the same thing we're wondering. You know, what is actually going on here? And Jesus tells them that their inability stems from their little faith. What are we to make of this? He said to them, because of your little faith, so why could we not cast it out? Again, that word, unable. Why were we unable to cast it out? He said to them, because of your little faith. Their problem was their little faith. Now, what Jesus is going to do for the rest of this verse is he's actually going to provide us with kind of an analogy or an exaggerated statement about what little faith can do. So why does Jesus rebuke them for their little faith? Something that we've seen frequently throughout these accounts with the disciples. We don't know precisely how this little faith, the little faith that they had, manifested itself in their exorcism or their attempts at an exorcism. What exactly were they trying to do? Was there some sort of incantation? Was there some sort of prayer? Was there some sort of formula that they were using to drive the demon out? We don't know exactly what their approach was to that. But he says that it stems, their inability to do it, stems from their little faith. Now they could have been perhaps overconfident. Perhaps they had thought that they had got this down. We've mastered the ability to cast out demons. Perhaps they were overconfident that they didn't think that they would encounter a demon or a demonic oppression such like this. Perhaps they were affected by the doubts of the crowds, as we have already mentioned. Maybe they were looking at it like the crowds were looking at it, like this is a hopeless cause. There's no way that we're going to be able to actually accomplish this. Everybody else thinks it's not going to happen, and they start to think that perhaps it's not going to happen. Maybe it was their little bit of doubts. Obviously, the situation is pretty tough, pretty challenging. I think the only thing that seems similar to this is the guy, the demoniac, the guy who's running around in the graveyard naked, breaking chains and, you know, scaring people away. I mean, that seems like a very tough case as well. But here it's a child. I think what he's trying to get at is that they perhaps had seen or perceived that their approach to casting out demons was maybe a formula. Maybe it was a little bit mechanical. Maybe it was a gift that they had been given that they could exercise at their own will. Maybe they just thought that Jesus gave us authority, therefore we have authority to go out and do what we want to do. Cast out demons as we see fit. The authority that they had been gifted at their commissioning is not an automatic or mechanical power. It's not one that operates independently from a connection, a relationship-based connection between Jesus and the disciples, or between disciples and Jesus. It's not like that. In fact, it's not even close to that. Jesus did not just give them raw power to use at their own will. He intended that they would rely upon him to carry out their commission. That they would trust him as they're out there seeking to bring healing, seeking to bring restoration, seeking to cast out demons and heal the sick. That's how he intended that authority to be used. And yes, he did give them that authority. And yes, it is the authority that they used in the book of Acts. What is it that we see the apostles doing? We see them doing things just like this. Healing the sick, raising the dead, cleansing lepers, making the blind see. So what he gave them was not a new technique or a formula that would guarantee their dominance over evil spirits. That is not the way that this authority works. Their little faith here, look at what Jesus says, "For I truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, nothing will be impossible for you. You will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." So the power then that is described here in moving mountains is not related directly to the amount of faith someone has. Faith like a grain of a mustard seed. That would be, by definition, a little faith. So their little faith that he says that they have in verse 20 really is not faith at all. Because if they had a little faith, then nothing is impossible for them. They can move mountains. We think of the great, you know, coffee cup verses. This is it right here. Faith like a grain of a mustard seed. You could say to this mountain, move from here to there and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. That's the same word. That word translated impossible is the same word that's used to describe the inability of the disciples to heal this child. They were unable to do so. Now, with just a mustard seed size amount of faith, they can do anything. But of course, we struggle with these sorts of statements, right? Like, anything? Nothing will be impossible? How are we to actually understand the degree to which Jesus is actually describing here? Because we know that faith, even a very small size, can move mountains. Mustard seed size faith can do anything, but it's not the faith that is doing it. It's God. It's the God of unlimited power that's actually doing it. Our faith and his exercise as a way in which we connect to God, we trust him to do his work. We can't heal anybody. We certainly can't cast out demons. It's God that has to do that. That's why faith is so necessary. Because it's not a power that we have. It's not a formula that he's given us. It's our connection with him. We're connected to the God who has unlimited power. So God can move the mountains. Of course, this is exaggeration, hyperbole here. The comparison or contrast between just a little bit of faith, the smallest of all seeds, right? The little mustard seed-sized faith and the gigantic, massive mountain. The mountain that Jesus is probably pointing to, right? The mountain of transfiguration. This little amount of faith can move this mountain. Of course, I think I was just talking to a co-worker this week, and he was struggling with God's promises and how they relate to his requests and prayer. And his lament was, he gave God a very specific list of all these really good things that he wanted, and God didn't give him any of it. In fact, God gave him the exact opposite of that. And he's struggling with the idea of a cruel God and how God can be perhaps giving blanket statements like this and then wrestling with the fact that he's not experiencing it in his own life. He's not really seeing God's promises come to pass. In fact, God seems to be doing the exact opposite of what he said he would do. So we had to spend some time discussing God's will and providence and our requests and how sometimes those things don't really match up. We can't take all of these statements and just say, we get whatever we want. God alone knows best. These statements here, I think, specifically address to the disciples themselves, the ones that he has actually commissioned to go out and heal the sick and cast out demons. The ones that we see with a new faith in the book of Acts actually carrying these things out. So, as we skip to the last passage here, we need to spend a little bit of time understanding what's taking place with this idea of a temple tax. So we have the faith or the faithlessness of the disciples in 14 through 20. Now we have freedom. The freedom of the sons in 24 through 27. So they are now making their way from Caesarea Philippi down through Galilee to Capernaum. They're heading towards Jerusalem. And the question is posed to Peter about the 2 drachma tax. Tax collectors want to know if this is something that Jesus pays. Does he pay the tax or not? The 2 drachma tax, I think two drachmas was worth half a shekel. So when Peter finds the fish with a shekel in its mouth, that's 4 drachmas. So, you know, 2 payments are offered up by that. You know, thinking about ancient currency. A little too early in the morning for that. But this would be something that was perhaps controversial. Some people would, a little bit more patriotic, would, you know, perhaps pay the tax, perhaps they wouldn't for different reasons. But the question, you know, is pretty legitimate. Most people think that this tax is based off of a tax that's described in Exodus chapter 30. And we'll look at that in a little bit. And they want to know whether or not Jesus pays the tax. And Peter says, yes. And then privately, Jesus speaks to Peter. And he asks them, what do you think, Simon, from whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? So what is the question going? Why that question? Why does he ask him that question? So was it a responsibility of every Jewish male to pay the tax? The tax was for the temple, paying for the sacrifices and paying for the priests and paying for everything that took place in the temple. So who gets to pay the tax? Well, the subjects of the kings get to pay the tax. And that's the answer that Peter provides. So Jesus asks him, the kings of the earth, the rulers, who are they going to tax? They're going to tax the subjects. They're not going to tax their own children. Why would they exact a payment from their own children? Their children are the heirs of everything. They're partakers of the very kingdom, the very rule of those rulers. The tax is extracted from the subjects. And Peter wisely answers the correct way. And he said, from others. Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. So what is Jesus getting at? The sons don't pay the tax. The backdrop, like I said, is the temple. Who does the temple belong to? Does the temple belong to the people? Does the temple belong to the kings of the earth? It belongs to God. It's his temple. So who is going to make payment then for the temple? Is it going to be the sons? Or is it going to be the subjects? Is God going to make his sons or his son pay the temple tax? No. He's not going to do that. The sons are free. The sons are not obligated to pay that tax. Now, I think there's two ways to look at it. We could either see Jesus here referring to his God as king of the temple. Therefore, he does not have to pay. He is not obligated to pay the temple tax. Or we could see it as Jesus is Lord of the temple. And his followers, his sons, his brothers do not have to pay the temple tax. I think both of those could be, we could understand being true. I think probably more likely Jesus is referring to his God, his father, as the owner, the ruler of the temple. Therefore, he doesn't have to pay. He's not obligated to make payment. But notice that there is a willingness to, I'm going to say condescend, that's probably not the right word. There's a willingness then not to give unnecessary offense. So then we have that, you know, the great story of Jesus providing this payment for Peter to make that would cover both Peter's payment and Jesus's payment by catching a fish and taking the shekel coin out of the fish's mouth, right? We don't actually have that described here as taking place. That's just what Peter or Jesus tells Peter to go do. So Jesus and his followers are not obligated to pay the temple tax, but they're free to pay it if they wish. In order to not give offense to those that would perhaps have a bad view or negative view of them, Jesus says, well, we're free to pay it. We're free not to pay it, we're free to pay it. So I'll provide you with the right amount, the specific amount that you need to pay for you and I. So I think what we have happening here, this is kind of astonishing because Jesus wasn't afraid to actually offend people, right? But here he sees it as he doesn't want to give offense. He doesn't want to give unnecessary offense. Because ultimately, the temple tax really doesn't mean much. This is not a do or die issue. This is not an essential. This is kind of out there in freedom land. You can do it if you want, but you don't have to. Why? Because you're my son. Sons aren't obligated to make that payment. So I think if we see that, we understand what's taking place, we have this great statement about Jesus, his relationship to the temple. Remember what he said, that someone greater than the temple is here. His relationship here is one in which he does not want to give unnecessary offense, that he is free to pay, free not to pay, because this is not a do or die issue. I think ultimately, as we read from Exodus, this is Exodus 30, we have a great tie-in to communion. Let me read from Exodus. This is where the tax is, they think the tax is alluded to from this passage. Exodus 30, verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, when you take the census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. Each one who is numbered in the house in the census shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary, half a shekel as an offering to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering. The rich shall not give more and the poor shall not give less. Then the half shekel when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for your lives. You shall take the atonement money from the people of Israel and shall give it to the service for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may bring the people of Israel to remembrance before the Lord, so as to make atonement for your lives. What were they doing? They were buying their ransom. They were giving a ransom money, a redemption money, a redemptive money, so that they could be free, so that they could be the people, so that the priests in the tabernacle could actually make atonement for them. That their tax is described here as an atonement. So how does that connect us then to communion? What was it that Jesus paid? So we had a debt that we could not pay. He made atonement. So he did ultimately. He paid a tax, so to speak. He offered up an atonement. offered up a sacrifice, not for his own sin, not for his own debt, but for the debt of others. So we see ultimately, I think, because of this relationship between the tax and the atonement and the sacrifices in the tabernacle, we actually get a better picture of what Jesus is describing here. Is he obligated to give up this atonement, to give up this tax, to pay this payment? No. But we've also seen, as we've gone through Matthew 16 and 17, that it is necessary, it must happen, that the Son of Man be offered up, that he must suffer, that he must be killed. So, yes and no. He offers this up, this payment up, sacrificially, willingly, and freely, so that we could be the sons and not have to make payment for ourselves. So I think that gives us a deeper understanding, I think, of what is happening in this passage. One that Peter could not quite grasp fully, but one that we can look back on and say, there's another element here that's taking place. Another element that gives us the freedom that we have. Because he came, as it said, to pay a debt he didn't owe, because we owed a debt we couldn't pay. And as we sing, Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. As he hangs on the cross and he yells out triumphantly, "It is finished." That word meaning paid in full. The debt has been paid. Now we can come freely to the table to receive him through faith. So let's do so now, as we have a